I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey guys, welcome to And the Writer Is. I'm your host, Ross Golan. I've written with hundreds of artists and writers over the years, and my favorite part of each session is the first hour when we catch up about life, the industry, politics, composition, whatever. So this is a journey of learning why people write songs, how people write songs, and most importantly, who the people are who write the songs. I'm producing this with the great Joe London, Big Deal Music Publishing, and Mega House Music Management. If you want to listen to the songs we discuss in this podcast, follow us on our socials, find out about special live events, or buy that merch, aka that hat I always wear, go to our website, www.andthewriteris.com. Welcome to And the Writer Is. I am your host, Ross Golan. Today's legend slash artist slash songwriter slash film composer is an epically skillful pianist and emotionally deep lyricist. This multi-Grammy award-winning Swiss Army Knife of Composition's first hit, The Way It Is, discussed institutional racism, homelessness, and civil rights, cloaked by an evergreen chorus with a melody infectious enough to become a hit multiple times, including when it was sampled by the greatest West Coast rapper of all time, Tupac. After the release of his eponymous album by the same name, The Way It Is, he won Best New Artist at the Grammys and since released another 20 albums, maybe played on 100 albums, sold millions of albums, and got another 12 nominations, all whilst working alongside the great Spike Lee, composing over 6 film scores. He's recently released a new project just this year, collaborating with everyone from Bon Iver's Justin Vernon and The Shins' James Mercer. From Old Williamsburg, Virginia, this overachiever is a genuine family man. And the writer is Bruce Hornsby. I don't know if any of that was accurate, but it seemed close.
Well, you had a lot of chutzpah there reading it, and a lot of get up and go. And at least I think one thing is accurate. One bit was accurate. Overachiever. I think it's safe to say that when I was in college, no one would have said, "Oh, that guy, yeah, he's really got it. He's going to be something, whatever, something." A special. There were certainly some people in my college, University of Miami, that were marked for greatness. A great. I played in this woman's band, Carmen Lundy. It was always sort of a mark that you were moving forward, moving up the hierarchy in the city of Miami's musical circles, and at least in the jazz-ish circles. And so. Carmen Lundy was her name. I played on her senior recital, and you could just see that she was just bound for greatness, and she ended up achieving that. She's had a great career as a jazz singer.
Before we get to the beginning of your story, what do you think's the difference maker between those people that you felt were marked for greatness and what you ended up achieving? Why do you feel like you had... Why it worked out for you if you feel like you weren't marked for that same greatness?
Well, okay. Number one, I was a late starter. So when I was in the aforementioned time in music school at Miami, I'd only been playing the piano for 3 years at that time. I was a jock before then. I played music. I had a little band in sixth grade playing guitar. And every kid played guitar because they wanted to be the Stones or the Beatles. I got into piano late junior year of high school. So maybe I've been playing 4 years by the time I got to UM. So that's one thing. I'm just trying to catch up. at that point in my life. And there was so much to learn. And so I was deeply involved, and I was a real grinder. I was always in the practice rooms, always, again, trying to catch up. I was just willing to do the work. But that's one thing where that would have kept me from being marked for greatness, because I had such a late start that I really was not too fully formed then in any way. That's one thing. I don't know how to really put all this. Once I got deeply involved, I do think that I was fairly tunnel visioned about trying to, but from a certain point, probably about from my mid-20s on, I really sort of grokked the idea of finding your own voice, finding yourself, your own style, maybe musically, in my case, pianistically, and finding your voice as a songwriter, trying to not be derivative, to not be generic, to not just sound like everyone else, to not just to try to do something with a little more depth and gravitas than just writing a hit song. Okay, so so that's a couple. That's just me just spouting off, trying to somehow answer this tough question.
No, I mean it's a tough way to start. I feel like I should have asked you something that was funny or something to begin.
Well, we can get to funny. I can try anyway.
You can do funny.
I'll try.
Let's start from the beginning. You know, being born in the 50s, it's a different kind of music that you were listening to, I'm sure, than, you know, what kids are listening to now. So, you know, you're born in Williamsburg, a very classic town in the United States. Were your parents in music? Did they play music? Did they listen to music?
Well, speaking of just to speak to your characterization of Williamsburg, I don't know if you ever heard of the legendary old rock critic writer Paul Nelson. It was actually a book written about Paul. He was a deep guy, and he wrote for loads of magazines, and he did a piece for me about me in for Musician Magazine, the late great Musician Magazine. Pretty extensive piece, and he came to Williamsburg. He was a venerable old sage at the time, an older gentleman, still with the letting his freak flag fly. You know, he looked like an old hippie, basically, or maybe one of Kerouac's pals, you know, Ginsberg's pals in the Beat era. And so I met him, and he was staying at the Williamsburg Lodge. And he said, "Man, this place is really creepy." He said, I walked around Colonial Williamsburg, and I just got the heebies, you know. So I've always thought, okay, well, here's an outsider with possibly the truest perspective on it.
It's hard to explain that town if you've never been there.
Right.
It's a place that really – explain
yes.
Williamsburg.
Yes, thank you, because people are going, well, what is he talking about? So thanks for moving me there. Williamsburg is known for its restored colonial town, Colonial Williamsburg. You can walk the streets and meet people. You can walk the streets in your tricorn hat and your powdered wig, maybe shoot a musket. That's something they've put in to draw more tourists. To draw the accolades of the NRA, and so that can be either sort of inspiring if you're interested in history and wanting to see this reenactment of it, and or it can be maybe a little creepy. That's what Williamsburg is known for. Although now it's known for Busch Gardens, because Anheuser-Busch has a brewery here. But mostly, perennially, historically, it's been all about Colonial Williamsburg, and that's what the late great Paul Nelson was casting aspersions upon. You asked about my parents.
I was gonna say, because it's not like you guys were listening to 18th century only 18th century music.
We were not. Although we could, when you grow up in a small town, not a lot to do. There's certain for us. There was one thing that we would always do on a weekend of boredom. We would often go and watch the Colonial Williamsburg orientation film, The Story of the Patriot, with featuring Jack Lord of future Hawaii Five-0 fame as John Fry, House of Burgesses member. So we would walk around the town going, are we so meek and pusillanimous? Are we such adultish people as to swallow this absurd distinction? Is it disloyalty? Is it sedition to oppose the hand of tyranny? Never. We are free Englishmen with the God-given right to tax ourselves, and we shall not yield that right, not to Parliament, not to towns, and not to the king himself. So that's what we did in our childhood. We learned that.
Legendary. I feel like I want to put a melody to that. We should sample that right there.
Okay, possible. Yeah, so you asked about my parents. Music music was always in our house. My mom's dad, Paul Saunier, was a musician for a living in Richmond, VA. And he was the house organist at the local mosque. If you'd go to the state JC's convention, you'd see Pierre Paul Saunier, jamming out on Turkey in the Straw on the big theater organ there. He was also supervisor of music in the public schools. The public school system of Richmond featured Paul Saunier. And so my mom was a pianist, and my dad played a little sax. His older brother, Sherwood Hornsby, had a band. We have a poster over here advertising a dance featuring Sherwood Hornsby and the Rhythm Boys, little big band action, sort of Glenn Miller, Harry James vibe. And so, yes, again, it was always around. My parents, this tape may be lost at this point, but there for years existed a reel-to-reel tape of all of us little children, probably little children singing different songs. They have me singing Hound Dog at age 3 and Pat Boone with The Wind and the Rain in Your Hair. Charlie Brown, He's a Clown, He's Gonna Get Caught, coasters. So there was always, there's proof in that tape that we were singing and performing music as little kids. And so my older brother got really deeply involved a little later. Again, I was more into every sport in its season, but Bobby Hornsby was the guy in, say, junior high school who had soul bands and psychedelic bands. He had a band called Love Minus Zero that played, Love. And I don't know if you know the band Love. They were sort of...
Sure, of course.
Yes. What's that?
Of course.
Moby Grape, whatever they played. They played psychedelia, Hendrix, etc. But then he had a soul band that played Wilson Pickett and Otis Redding and Sam and Dave and that sort of thing too. So it was always around.
When did, that's such a wide variety from Glenn Miller to, psychedelic.
The gambit was run. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No doubt. When did you start playing? Because I assume piano was your first instrument, just knowing, the lineage that you come from and then also your knowledge of chord changes. I would assume that that's just been in your blood the whole time. Were you playing through all those sports seasons, or was music introduced later as something you should perform?
Yeah, the legend has it that I asked to take piano lessons when I was 7. So I did that. I took from Miss Garrison at Garrison's funeral home. If you want, you had to go to the 3rd floor, to the top of the house, and you'd walk by the caskets and embalming fluids. So it was a little out for a little 8-year-old kid to be doing that in that milieu. But I only did that for a year, and then I stopped doing that. I just wasn't interested enough and just said, hey, can I stop? And so it was fine. So that was my first foray into music, into keyboard specifically. But then about age maybe 10, 11, probably following my older brother's footsteps because he was really into it. But I was kind of into it too. And I played guitar. I learned how to play guitar and had the aforementioned band playing everything from Cherry Cherry to Get Off My Cloud to Mushroom Clouds Are Falling by Love, I think. And so we played Battle of the Bands, 6th grade, 12 years old. But again, I was more into the games and sports. And then later on, still stayed into that athletic pursuit until my junior year, when my older brother, again, influential older brother, had gone away to prep school in New England, in Connecticut. So he was instantly less provincial in his musical knowledge than we were, basically listening to the top 40 in the Soul Station back and forth in southeastern Virginia. So he came home and turned me on to Joe Cocker, Mad Dogs and Englishmen, with the great Chris Stainton piano and organ and the great Leon Russell piano and arrangements. It just turned me out. I just thought it was, I get chills thinking about it right now. And then he turned me on to, and that was music that you didn't hear around here because it wasn't on the radio. And it was the underground. I guess they called it FM rock at the time. And also he turned me on to, I'll never forget this, driving down the Colonial Parkway from Williamsburg to Yorktown, the hysterical triangle, as they call it, and Jamestown, Yorktown, Williamsburg. We're riding down there to visit our cousins, and he's in his GTO, and he's got his 8-track tape of Tumbleweed Connection by Elton John, and he puts in this song called Amarina. I'd heard your song on the radio, that I knew a little bit, and it was good. I was fine with that. But this thing just, again, turned me out like the Mad Dogs record did. And so much so that I wanted to investigate. And I said to myself, okay, I want to learn how to do this. It got me, again, it's fun. It's interesting what gives you chills in your body. And that did again. So I went home and I knew the basic chords on the piano because my brother taught me those chords, because they needed a guy to play organ in their soul band for a minute while the real organ player, organist, was out somewhere. So I started just learning from my basic knowledge that I had, my little meat-headed chord knowledge. And it just became my pursuit. I was a hooper before that. I was a baller. But when I got into this, man, the music overtook the hoops, the basketball thing, and I got totally immersed in it, submerged in it, and then it just kept on from there.
Did it inspire you to write, or did it inspire you to play?
Well, not yet. Although we did write, we weren't very serious in school. We just pulled a lot of crap and pranks and. We were really into Abby Hoffman's Steal This Book. I don't know if you've seen the recent Netflix.
I don't know that.
Okay. You know who Abby Hoffman was? You know Abby
Hoffman? I don't know. Who's Abby Hoffman?
Okay. Well, this is great. This is a classic 60s American history for you. And it's sort of timely it's absolutely timely because on Netflix right now, as it was just released, I don't know, a week ago and reviewed in the Times, Aaron Sorkin wrote and directed a new movie called The Trial of the Chicago Seven. Okay.
Correct.
So Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin, they were the twin leaders of the Yippie movement. Okay. And Sacha Baron Cohen plays Abby Hoffman in the movie. And he's fantastic in this. It's very good, this movie, I think. We just saw it last
week.
It's brilliant. So now you know what
I know who you're now talking you're about. Yeah.
Okay. So Abby Hoffman wrote a book. So back then, we as young clowns, we loved all these. We loved Jerry Rubin and Abby Hoffman. Abby Hoffman's first book was Revolution for the Hell of It, and so we were all in on that. But when he put out his next one, Steal This Book, we immersed ourselves in that, and so. Oh, we became a Universal Life Church ministers. You could send away for a buck and get your minister's card. And we could have performed weddings and funeral services. And we had a band booking company that booked only the shittiest bands in town. We would only book a band if they were terrible. And we would reserve the right to name them. So we had such bands as the Uncommon Cold, the Benign Tumor, the Soul Basketball, the Psychedelic Sound System, just just inanity. Okay. And so we wrote, I was at this point, I was deeply into Leon, and Leon Russell had a, had his great company called Shelter Records, record company. I was a total Shelter devotee. I'd get every J.J. Cale record that came out, the Freddie King records, the three great blues records that Leon produced for Freddie King. So in Steal This Book, Abby told us that you could, if you want to get free books and records, make some fancy stationery that has the title of your magazine or that you publish, and write to the publishers and the record companies saying, well, this is our magazine, and we do regular reviews of books and records, and please put us on your mailing list. So we wrote to Columbia Records, Warner Brothers, and Shelter, and the only one who wrote us back and sent us records was Shelter. So, of course, at that point, now, if I wasn't into Leon before, I was all in now. And so this was, I don't know how I got off on the frivolity of our youth, but you led me there. So how did that happen?
No, that's perfect. No, I think what's interesting is, you know, 1968 and, you know, talking about the Chicago 7 and
yes, the Democratic Convention and the and yes, the protests. Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm.
My mother was there. I'm from Chicago.
That's something to be proud of. Yeah.
Yep. I imagine that, you know, there's no way that politics isn't also infused in your music listening at that time.
Well, it was everywhere. It was ubiquitous. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, side question, why is it that this generation in such a divided time, why is it that music, popular music, yeah, doesn't seem to talk about politics at all? It exists in, you know, it really exists in hip hop, and it always has.
Yes.
You know, that's what makes that genre sort of the folk music of our generation. You know,
certainly, that's right. On a protest, folk as protest music level, absolutely.
There were hits that were protest songs,
but not so many when you look back. I said music of today. I was going to say, well, wait a minute, the popular music of today does it. But then you said it yourself. That's a key addition to that statement, because obviously protest music now is kind of all over the place, but it's under the mainstream radar screen because the popular music of our day, just like any day, it tends to be more kids stuff. You know, it tends to be more, you know, TikTok and just more love songs, whatever. I don't want to disdain, to besmirch it, but the protest music is not what they're looking for, and they never were looking for it really on hit radio. So I don't think this time is any different. If you went back and look at the hits of the day in the 60s, you'd see it was not dissimilar. It obviously, stylistically, it's totally different now. Different styles have evolved, and that's what's supposed to happen in a great way. But look, you had Barry McGuire, The Eve of Destruction. Now, that was a protest song that was a hit. Dylan's songs, I don't think Blowing in the Wind, Times They Are Changing, were hits, but they were certainly known to a large underground populace. And I think that's the same way now. A perfect example, my song, The Way It Is, which was made, you know, obviously famously, was remade by Tupac Shakur. His song Changes in 98. Well, that song, if you go by the charts, Changes by Tupac got to number 32 on the Billboard Hot 100. So that's not that great. But Changes by Tupac is an iconic song. You know, it doesn't need, it has its life totally divorced from hit radio. And it's, again, same thing back then, same thing now.
Yeah, I think a lot of people don't realize how many, and I use the word evergreen in the intro, but how many evergreens were not hits? You know, I think there's this statistic where the only Bruce Springsteen song that ever went number one was the Man for Man cover of
Blinded by the Light.
But that he never had a number one song at radio is shocking when you think about how many songs he has that are hits. And, you know, when you look back and you see the top 10 songs of any specific week, you will not know 8.5 of them.
Exactly. So that's the point, that now these times, in that sense, the times haven't been a change in really in that in the music business. But that's the way it always was. And that's how I guess it always will be. And who cares? Just so if you're really deeply invested, you're going to find great music. You may have to really dig for it. But if you want it bad enough, you'll find it. There's such amazing music out now.
No doubt.
But you have to look for it.
You went to school in the 70s to college. At least what I found is that you had gone to music school at University of Richmond and maybe also Berkeley and University of Miami. Is that right? Where am I wrong here?
That there was no music school per se at University of Richmond. I spent my one misguided year at real college at U of R, and I spent all my time in the Modlin Fine Arts Building practicing, and then which made me realize, well, I need to cast my lot with the musos. And so I went to, again, I was just a kid from small town Virginia. I had no mentor. I had to just figure it out, which is it's just good. You should be able. And so I went down a few roads that were not productive, but then realized and came back. You're just trying things and trying to figure it out. So the only music school I really knew about, because a guy I knew had gone there, was Berkeley in Boston. Berkeley with two E's, as opposed to Cal Berkeley. And so I went there for two semesters and then transferred to University of Miami. I had designs. I had an idea. I wanted to go to New England Conservatory, which was right down the street from Berkeley. I'd gotten really deeply into modern classical music. When I lived in Boston, the Boston Public Library was an amazing resource. You could go and check out records like you could check out books. And they had a voluminous collection of modern music. I'd say to 20th century music. So I got really into Ives and Satie and Stravinsky and on and on there. And so I guess I felt that I wanted to go in that direction and wanted to go to New England Conservatory. So I auditioned and I made this tape. I tried to play very difficult music. It's laughable, stuff that I can hardly play now. I was trying to play it then when I had no business. The tape was horrible. The guy called me up and said, look, I'm not letting you in, but I can tell there's something there. And some promise there. So why don't you try University of Miami? And of course, I'd never heard of that either. So I lived in a farmhouse that for 4 months, that was in early January of my sophomore year of college. Ended up living out in a farmhouse with a crazy friend of mine, and we're playing a piano bar, cocktail lounge thing to make a buck. And I practiced 8 hours a day for every day for 4 months. And then 4 months later made a tape for University of Miami. And it's amazing how much you can improve if you're willing to put that much time into it every day. And so the tape was better. They let me in and I spent 2 years there, which was a huge thing for me. I had a very tough teacher, Vince Maggio. I still consider him to be my teacher. He was really hard on me, but he was great. He was a teacher that could not only talk the talk, but could walk the walk. He couldn't wait to move you off the piano to show you how to do it. And he could really show you. So I love Vince, as do most of his students. Although, like I say, he was tough. He said to me at first, you are terrible, but if you'll do this and this and this and this and this, you won't be terrible, maybe. And so
I mean, it's really good advice from a mentor, and I think people don't want to hear, you know, and again, I don't know if this is generational or not, but my assumption is that people now more than ever don't want to hear that they were, that they're not good.
Well,
that there's a lot of placation. And I remember a teacher freshman year of college, my voice teacher, saying, you sound like a white kid from the suburbs. You need to learn to yell. And this was in my, because I studied jazz vocals. You need to like, and I didn't, you know, jazz vocals to me was Glenn Miller. It wasn't Louis Armstrong, if we're going back to that. Like, I didn't understand the idea of pain.
Well, I still don't understand it. Who yells in jazz vocals? I think of yelling, I think of Joe Strummer, you know, I think of, you know, Johnny Rotten.
Still good advice. Much rather sound like him than what I sounded like then.
Oh, yeah.
But you want to have mentors that say, you're not doing it right. Even now, like, do you now play your music for anybody who says, oh, you can beat this?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I don't live in a vacuum, and pretty much I don't think I really ever have. Mostly from idiocy. I what I thought was good is not. So, hey, listen to this thing I just did, and then I realize, oh, yeah, it's pretty bad. yes, I think that it was always the same in this sense, though. I think it was always a tough blow to a kid's ego in 1974, the same tough blow that it is now. So that was hard on me when Vince told me that. Took me a while to sort of, I recoiled in horror, and then I came back and decided, well, okay, let me see investigate this, see what he's talking about. Again, it's just a kid from small town South, just trying to figure it out. And so I, of course, in hindsight, you always say, oh, thank you for the criticism. But in the moment, I don't think that's ever changed. I guess I'm trying to say that maybe the kids today, as you're saying, are more sensitive or have a thinner skin. That may be true. I kind of think I had semi-thin skin then too.
What was the impulse to write music and record music? Because at that point, you're starting to get an education in music, but there's a big leap. You know, you graduate and, you know, then the first time I can really find recorded music, we're talking 10 years later from after graduating college. So
Yeah. Well, that's when I got signed. It was right. 8 years after I graduated from college. Again.
So what happened between those 8 years? How do you go from, I'm a student who has a mentor who's saying you suck, but you can get better, to as a songwriter, getting to the quality level of getting record deals?
Well, they're two completely different disciplines, different aesthetics. They're just different approaches, learning, you know, dealing with virtuosity on the instrument, and then also writing songs of some depth and quality. That they're two different paths. They're different roads that you need to go down. So when I got out of college, I was way farther along on the playing end than I was as a writer, because I had just been trying to do that. That had been my focus in college: just get the instrument together, or more together than you are now. So I really didn't get serious about the writing until we came back here. I graduated in 77 from UM, came back here with a couple of my brother and sister-in-law in the band, and that ever-present older brother, he returns to the story. I played in his Grateful Dead cover band when I was a freshman in college at University of Richmond. He was a big deadhead. He was in a classic UVA freak fraternity that used to drop acid, paint their faces, and go play intramural volleyball. It's just beautiful. They were lucky if they even hit the ball once.
I just love that, you know, I mean, we'll get to it later, but the fact that you were in a, you know, to be in a Grateful Dead cover band and then later play with the Grateful Dead is just bananas. Like, you can't write that kind of stuff.
I know. It sounds like terrible writing if you do write that.
It really does.
Yeah, painting yourself into the mural that you were looking at as a kid. That's kind of what has happened, what happened to me, amazingly enough. What's that?
You go home, you're writing with your brother, and you're writing with your sister-in-law,
No, no,
right?
No, not right. No, I was a solitary pursuit. No, so we come home, and we put this band together with a couple of my Miami friends who came up to play guitar and drums. And so, okay, I guess I was a silently elected band songwriter. Nobody else was doing it. And I guess I had the knowledge, the harmonic knowledge to go to various places that other people may not have been able to go. So I started writing songs. And about a year and a half into our band, so I guess around the end of 78, we had amassed a group of my songs, maybe about 10 or so. And we were playing them on our gigs. We were just playing your standard top 40 lounges. And we played the odd frat party too, the odd rock and roll club in North Carolina where they wanted to hear Black Oak, Arkansas, and Black Betty Bama Lamb. You know, they wanted to, that's, we were not their people. They didn't like us. We were playing too much Earth, Wind, and Fire, you know. So I was figuring it out gradually in my muddle-headed fashion, and had written some songs that made it that people liked enough that we were able to flip the audience at these lounges to the point where the people populating the clubs, we were filling the clubs with people who didn't want to hear us play Brick House or Shake Your Booty. They wanted to hear my songs. And so that's a real trick. It's hard to do, but it helped us continue to work and still develop this original music thing, because the club owners don't care why they're there. They just want people in their club. So, okay, this place is crowded and you're playing some shit I don't know and don't even like it probably, but hey, there's people here, so you guys keep the job. So that was a pretty good trick we were able to pull there, purely from people liking the music. So we liked at
the how did you know they liked it besides clapping at the end of your set? Were you recording it and selling it? Were people asking you afterwards? How do you know people like your songs?
Well,
in that
okay,
era?
Because after a certain point, that's all we're playing and they keep coming. Okay.
Right.
Okay. And when you light into, for whatever reason, you light into, so I'd like to know where you got the notion, rock the boat, don't rock the boat, baby, rock the boat, don't kick the, you know, when you go into that and they sort of blanch in horror, sitting in their seats, sipping their beer, that lets you know why they're there. And so that, I guess that's how, no, so we, cause we weren't selling anything. We weren't making any demos, but we liked Steely Dan. You know, we came out of jazz school, so we're into jazz-influenced pop. Sounds like you went through a similar crucible in jazz school with a tough teacher. So we liked Steely Dan, but we also liked Mike McDonald, who had been in Steely Dan, and now he was the lead singer with the Doobie Brothers. So we'd play some of their songs, the Mike McDonald songs. It Keeps You Running, I Know You're Made That Way. These are some songs we would do for Mike's. And the people liked those because they liked this music because it was stylistically akin to what I was doing, sort of. So the Doobie Brothers were playing Hampton Coliseum, and we were playing across the street at the Hampton Steak and Ale, okay, and Lounge. And we went over, we knew the same people that booked their big concerts, Whisper concerts, booked our little shit ass lounge gigs. And so we knew the Doobie Brothers were staying at the Sheraton Coliseum. So my drummer, John Molo, big guy, he and I walk into the lobby of the Sheraton Coliseum looking for Mike McDonald, and there he is. So we walk up to him and we said, "Hey, Mike, we're the baddest motherfuckers in this town, and we're playing over here at the Steak and Ale, so you should come hear us." So he looks up at us and he goes, "Well, okay, I'm going to the movies now, but I will if I can." And sure enough, he was a night off for the Doobie Brothers. They were playing the next night. He came over with some of the Doobies roadies. So we'd saved all our originals, you know, all my songs, and just wore it out. And he's there and he just flipped. And he comes up to me and says, "Oh my God, come back to the, let's have a drink. Let's hang out at the bar. Come up to my room. Let me play our new record that's being released tomorrow. It's called Minute by Minute," which was, of course, it was unbelievable. I can't believe it happened even now, but he was such a beautiful guy and remains so, of course. And so he was our first connection. I refer to him as my discoverer and founder. And so he helped us out. We went to LA. He turned us on to some people. That was during the era where Mike McDonald was singing on one third of the hit songs of the day. You know, his voice was in the background, whether it was Peg, Steely Dan, Lauren Woods, some song, and Christopher Cross, Ride Like the Wind. He was all over it. So he would turn our tape. We made a demo tape. It was pretty bad. He turned us on, turned the tape on to producers when he would go work for them. We slept on his floor for 10 nights. The 2 months later in Studio City, the aforementioned John Molo and I did. And anyway, long story short, we ended up coming out and showcasing for record companies and publishers the next summer. Jeff Baxter wanted to produce us. He was leaving the Doobie Brothers. You know Jeff Baxter? He was
I know of him. I've actually met Michael McDonald along the way, but never Jeff.
Okay, so Skunk Baxter, as he's called, took us into some rehearsal studio, parked us there for a month, and we played for all sorts of people. I found out later that most of the people hearing us referred to us as the band that looked like roadies, because we were hardly, we were just a bunch of greasy guys who were into music. And so we did that, and pretty much most of the labels passed on us. Only one was interested, and we didn't go with them, 20th Century Records. But the publishers liked what I was doing songwriting as a songwriter. So I ended up signing a songwriting deal with 20th Century Fox, and I moved to L.A. from that. And then three of the other guys moved, and my brother and sister-in-law, they stayed here in Williamsburg because they didn't want to go out and scuffle and play on milk commercials and shitty publishing demos, whatever you could do to make a buck while you're trying to get your thing going. So that was 1980, and I went to David Geffen's house and played him songs. I mean, this is crazy. Yeah, you're shaking your head a lot with this story.
I mean, well, it's like this is like my dream era, because I was born in '80, so like I listened. Okay. I grew up listening to all the music from, you know, my parents, from, you know, basically their childhood all the way through mine. But that era is the beginning of, you know, so much of the music that I'm currently trying to bring back in a lot of ways. You know, it's like,
I'll have to interview you about that.
Exactly. I mean, and David Geffen and him going from manager to label exec and being part of you're talking about Studio City, where I currently live. Oh, and uh-huh. We're right off Laurel Canyon, and you talk about Laurel Canyon in the 70s and early 80s and David Geffen's influence on that.
Incredible.
And you start when you say that you're playing for David Geffen in his sort of the first chapter of his prime, or his second chapter of his prime, like, that's just such a legendary thing. I'm sure a lot of people who listen to this are currently talking to their David Geffens in this music business, but
well,
you know, that's crazy. That's why I'm shaking my head. It's crazy, man.
Well, I guess
Michael McDonald in the middle of a like, what is this?
Well, as I hear you sort of marveling at all this, in the end, the reason this was happening, and I'm not trying to toot my horn because I don't think the music was really especially great then, but it had to have something to get these, because that's what hooked Michael, okay, and to help me out. And then when I signed with 20th, one of the song runners there was a young girl, a young woman named James Foster, who was David Foster's little sister. Shaking his head. So she turned my tape on to David Foster, and David wanted to sign me to his publishing company. This was just when he was just getting started as a producer. He had written After the Love Is Gone for Earth, Wind & Fire, you know, iconic hit for them. He produced a Hall & Oates record that wasn't particularly a big hit, but it was very good, made a little noise. So I signed with him. And so so we made this demo. The first session I did in L.A. was with, you know, the Cats. It had Mike Porcaro on bass and Jay Graydon on guitar and David playing electric piano, and I'm playing acoustic piano, and Carlos Vega on drums. I don't know if you know these names, but these are just seminal names from that era's studio scene, studio session scene. And so David Geffen heard that tape, and he instantly said, I want to see this kid. Okay. So I went with my publisher at the time, Ronnie Vance. We went up to David Geffen was living in Cher's house while she was somewhere else in Bel Air, Beverly Hills. And I would go up there, and David's there with he was starting his new label, didn't have a name yet. Okay. It wasn't called Geffen Records yet. He had signed one act, Donna Summer. He subsequently signed later that fall. So this is June of 1980. He later signed Elton and John Lennon in the fall. And John Lennon then was assassinated late that year. I think it was December of 80. I'm not sure. But yeah, anyway, so we go over there. Carol Childs, his A&R person, and Ronnie Vance and I were sitting there, and David's there. And so then he says to me, play me a song. There's a piano there. So I started playing this song that I'd recorded, that we had recorded on this demo. And it was one of those moments where the acoustics of the room were just glorious. You know, the man with the voice of 1,000 seagulls would have sounded amazing in this place. You know, would have sounded incredible here. So I'm very aware of this. Oh my God, I don't think I've ever sounded this good. I'm saying to myself as this is going on. And then when the song ended, David Geffen jumped up and said to me, Brucey, I want you to make records for me. And so I'm thinking, God, there's another chill I got thinking about remembering that moment. And so I thought to myself, wow, is it this easy? Well, alas, it was not that easy. And I never signed with Geffen. He then put my situation in the hands of Carol Childs and the another subsequent hire, A&R hire, the legendary John David Kolodner. So he's known, he's maybe best known as the rabbi looking cat with a wedding dress and Dude Looks Like a Lady.
Yeah, that's right.
Aerosmith's video. Yeah, yeah. That's him. Quite a successful and great A&R guy. So we waltzed around, David Foster and I waltzed around with Carol and Kolodner for about 3 or 4 months recording songs. My younger brother, John, had moved. He'd gone to Stanford, graduated that year, and moved down to L.A. to write with me. He was going to be my partner. And we ended up being partners. That was 80. We wrote songs together all the way through 92. He wrote Mandolin Rain with me. He wrote Valley Road. He wrote Look Out Any Window. Had some nice success with me a few years after that. So, but then they brought me into their office and said, Brucey, you're the kind of guy we want, but you're not ready yet. And I think they were right.
You know, one of the things that's crazy is a lot of times people get to know, in that era, a lot of times people would get signed off of their live show.
Yeah.
And in this era, a lot of people feel like they need to get signed off the live show. And I'm always telling people, no, get signed off your songs.
Well,
and no matter how big your live shows are, if the songs aren't going to work, it won't matter. It'll take you forever to stay at a very medium level versus if the songs are huge.
Well, I've got a standard line regarding all that. I think my story is an educational one because, okay, so we'll fast forward.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
So the Geffen people said, yeah, not yet, not quite. Then I had Warner Brothers, the great Lenny Warrenker, give me demo money the next year, made a demo, not right. This happened for years. Finally, and all this time, my brother and I are trying to find our own voice. Like I mentioned, try to find an area that was unique to us, that would carve out our own niche, musically, stylistically. And we were just pursuing that. I don't think we had it yet, really. We went down some goofy roads and came back. And anyway, so 1985 comes along. 84. I put together a band, The Range. By this time, because I wanted to hide behind a name, I thought Bruce Hornsby was a pretty crappy stage name. So I thought I would do like Mark Knopfler did and hide behind a name, Dire Straits for him, The Range for me. So we were The Range, and it was sort of, we were trying to affect our modern day version of the band before this whole area of music was titled under the umbrella Americana. That didn't exist then. We were trying to be, I guess, that. And our timing was probably pretty good because sort of in the zeitgeist of the time, Tom Petty was doing this. John Mellencamp was having incredible American rock records. Bruce Springsteen, of course, was doing this. And so we were doing our version. It was 1984. And we're playing all around L.A., Madam Wong's, Hop Sings, the Lingerie, all the clubs of the time. And we got a little head of steam. We got some interest, and about five labels offered us a deal, offered us demo money. We took Epic, and we made a demo for Epic, and they passed. And so sort of the lemmings consciousness of the L.A. show business, music business is such that, well, when all the other labels who had been interested heard that they passed, then they all passed too. You know, if they don't like it, must not be good. So here I'd gotten to a certain point and been busting it and trying to get writing these songs and playing accordion a lot, playing hammer dulcimer. There's more folk. I had David Mansfield playing fiddle mandolin, the great David, and he was in The Range for a couple of years there. And so I was up working for Sheena Easton. So I'm licking my wounds. I'm out on the road playing Morning Train, playing for your Eyes Only, blah, blah, blah on the road. I love Sheena. She treated me great. I was sort of the teacher's pet because she liked my music. She'd listen, you'd hear her warming up to my demo that everyone had just passed on. So I'm thinking, wow, I'm ruminating about all this. Okay, what next? So I just really finally, out of frustration, frankly, with the way the band was playing my songs, I decided to make a tape. I just bought a Linn drum machine, one of the early ones, and I made a demo tape of two songs, Mandolin Rain and The Way It Is, with the drum machine. There was again. I just got it again. Made this tape, and I thought, well, no major label. And I played piano on it, and I hadn't done that for a while because I didn't hear anybody playing piano. I was sort of following what was happening, and thought, well, that's not happening. So I play a DX7 or some idiocy, but this was just me unencumbered by anything but what I liked and what I wanted to do. So it was when my brothers heard it, they said, "Oh, this is the most you that we've ever heard. This is so pure and deep in that way." And so I thought no major label would have any interest in this, although I'd made inroads. I knew these people. They'd passed on me for years. And so I sent it to Wyndham Hill. I knew this woman, Dawn Atkinson. I'd worked on a George Lucas little animated film called Twice Upon a Time. I'd done a song for it, and she'd worked on it. So she was now working for Wyndham Hill, you know, the New Age label. They were starting a vocal label. So I sent it to her, and she called me back and said, "Wow, I love this. I can't stop listening to it. Are you doing any more?" I said, "Well, I just happened to be getting ready to cut two more songs." She said, "Can I come to the session?" So yes, come down. She flew down from the Bay Area, came to the session, and she took a little demo, a little rough mix that we put down at the end of the night's recording. It was just me with a drum machine and me playing everything synth bass on an Oberheim OBX piano, little pad, little string pad, whatever. The next day, Will Ackerman at Wyndham Hill called me up and said, "Hi, this is Will Ackerman. We'd like to sign you." So it was as simple as that. Then my lawyer, he heard it, and he said, "This is too good for Wyndham Hill. Let me have I want to disseminate this around." I said, "No, Fred, I think this is fine." But he talked me into it, and he gave it to his great friend, Paul Atkinson, the former Zombies rhythm guitar player, beautiful English man, who was the head of A&R at RCA. And he gave it to Paul. And Paul had been one of the ones, he knew me. He'd been one of the ones coming out to our shows the year before and had offered us demo money. We just hadn't picked them. We picked Epic. So then he had the same reaction. He called Fred and said, "I just can't take this cassette out of my car." And that's the point. It's easy in theory and extremely difficult in reality, but you have to create something that someone can't stop listening to, that gets so under their skin. It's, again, simple concept, but really hard in practice. And so that's what this little tape was. It was that tape. Then the guy at Epic Records, who had offered the demo money, then he starts getting wind of this. Then he offered us a deal. So Wyndham Hill was out. It was between Epic and RCA, and we picked RCA. So that's the story. But to me, like I say, it's a good story. It's an inspiring story for someone trying to do this. Of course, the music business is completely different. The major labels are not nearly the powerhouses that they were. It's not the same at all. So, but it's still, the basic idea will always be the idea, which is, it will always be the goal. You have to create something that gets under someone's skin, that they can't stop listening to. It just moves them so deeply in whatever way. And until you do that, then you're going to continue to try to do that. That's the goal.
These songs, you know, the way it is in Mandolin Rain in particular, are so, you know, if I brought into a session, I got a concept, Mandolin Rain, everyone would be like, "What else do you got?" Not because you couldn't.
You're probably right.
Like, it's not something that you just go and, like, what inspires that kind of lyric? Did that lyric come first? Where did that song come from?
No, the lyrics came later, but the idea of Mandolin Rain is just the idea of the standard mandolin trill.
Yeah.
Sounding like rainfall. That's it.
Yeah. So it's so smart. It's that, so, you know, you can try to go into sessions all the time. And a lot of the people who listen to this podcast are mostly just songwriters just trying to get cuts. And I don't know.
That's a completely different area. I can't speak to that because I'm totally not about. Yeah. What's that?
Being an artist.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean,
yeah, even that's right.
The way it is, what's great about the way it is, in different, you know, different than Mandolin Rain in this sense, is like that chorus, you could have written That chorus could be part of 1,000 different concepts. You know, it's the lyrics and it's the lyrics in the verses that really give it its gravitas. And yet, you know, you hear it, you know, you see people singing at karaoke. So it's something that they, you know, the meaning and the depth of the meaning is sort of is what you strive for as a writer, where when you listen to it on the third time, you're like, wow, these verses mean something.
Well, look, it's real easy, and it's a standard thing to Monday morning quarterback to in hindsight, look back and explicate why something was successful. I don't tend to do that. I'd have my own explanation for why I think the way it is was a hit. Again, my own version of the Monday morning quarterbacking, and that is this. So look, your guess is as good as mine. My guess is that I call the way it is a novelty record in a radio sense. In the best sense, I call Fast Car by Tracy Chapman a novelty record. I call Sultans of Swing by Darius Weiss a novelty record in the best sense, in that it's so different. It's pure luck, mind you, but they're so different than the standard baby, slick production, even now, the sort of modern R&B pop that gets played as top 40 now, I guess, because I don't follow it at all. But so I'm probably speaking completely from ignorance. But okay, I think the way it is was successful because it's a nice sound. It's a different sound. There's a guy soloing on piano. I think the lyrical aspect of pop hits is overrated. I think people really hear a sound that's intoxicating, and maybe but like you were just saying, by the third or maybe the 13th time, they're starting to clue into lyrics because it's just a sound that's drawn them in. So that's what I feel novelty in, again, the best sense. It's a sound that goes down easy. But it's a guy soloing on piano. So, wow, we don't hear that ever on radio. And so that's my, but again, that's just as full of beans as the next guy who's trying to, in hindsight, explicate why.
All the things that happened after that album, you know, there's such a quantity of music that you released, and you start working at some point in film and whatnot.
Only for one guy. I'm like Tom Hagen in The Godfather, he's a lawyer with one client, Don Corleone. I'm a film composer with one boss, Spike Lee. He's the only.
Spike Lee is a master at what he does.
No question.
How did you end up getting sucked into that world?
It's just like I hate to be simplistic about it, but the reason is the same as all these other things: Mike McDonald, David Geffen, Paul Atkinson, my lawyer, whoever, Wyndham Hill. The reason that Spike started wanting to work with me is that he likes what I do. It moves him.
Yeah.
It moves. It's as simple as that, and that's probably the reason for that most think these sort of things happen. You know, if somebody hears your music and they just love it, they want to get to know you. You know, they want to investigate. They want to know more about it and you. So that's the answer with Spike. He was a fan of my music. We had a mutual friend, Bransford Marsalis, who decided to hook us up for dinner. The three of us went out to dinner, and I asked him to, this was 92. I asked him to direct a video for an upcoming record I was making, a song about the first interracial romance in my town here in Williamsburg called Talk of the Town with Branford on sax. And he did that. And I've been working with him that now for 28 years. And so it's just continued. And it just became a deeper work relationship when he asked me in 2008 to start scoring for him. So, which led into my last two records, Absolute Zero and Non-Secure Connection, because over half of the songs on those two records emanated from score music that I'd written from Spike, hence the cinematic quality of it, at least to me. So how about that? I was able to deftly segue from 1992 to 2020.
I mean, it's brilliant.
How incredible. That.
You know, we'll go to the last segment. I'm going to list five things and just tell me what comes off the top of your head if you have, you know, this next little bit. But we'll just start with the Grateful Dead.
Just what comes to mind?
Just what comes to mind.
Where else can you play one song for an hour? The Grateful Dead is the place. Brilliant. Is the place to go for that. I guess that you want me to kind of riff.
Sure.
Riff
on it? It's so cool. Look, the reality is, you know, you got to play with the Grateful Dead.
Well,
and with Jerry Garcia while he was still alive.
Yeah, the Grateful Dead is a deep area of conversation and rumination, and there's so much to talk about. You know, there's quite a vast library of literature now that deals with the Grateful Dead oeuvre, the Grateful Dead history. So I could just that's a completely different podcast. But so in a nutshell, I guess I say this a lot, but I wouldn't trade my time with the Dead for anything. It was so deep, and I think they're vastly underrated as songwriters. I think their songwriting canon is comparable to any of the great songbooks in popular music history, American popular music history. That's my feeling, and so that's a good enough sort of end statement. That's really truly how I feel.
In Non-Secure Connection, your newest album, you featured some of the best and most influential artists currently. So I just wanted to ask about that. You know, Justin Vernon, James Mercer. That'll be my next one on my list.
Well, again, people would say goes hand in hand with exactly what we were talking about. We've been talking about the whole time. There's one common thread current running through this. Justin Vernon started shouting me out as one of his early influences. One of the reasons he got deeply involved in music, and then he called me or got in touch with me about working with him on a Grateful Dead tribute record called Day of the Dead. It's a 10 CD indie rock, massive magnum opus. And we did Black Muddy River because he liked my version of it from a record of mine called Here Come the Noisemakers, a live record from 2000. So we started working together, and we just kept on. We had about 5 years there where I was playing Coachella with him and playing at his festival, and he was singing on my Dulcimer record. And then we wrote a song for Absolute Zero, and then we wrote a song for his last record too. So it's just kept on going. But again, it all started the same way. He just was a real fan. And so he reached out because he wanted to, again, investigate more deeply. Now, James Mercer is actually not part of this thread, because that was me reaching out to him. I'd written this song. I love the Shins. My favorite Shins record is Wincing the Night Away. And there's a song on there called Spilt Needles, which just turns me out. I just think it's fantastic. Melodically, angular melodicism. He's a great lyricist, a transcendent singer. I just love what he does. So I'd written this song called My Resolve for the Non-Secure record, and a Sisyphean tale of the creative life. So I thought I would try to make it into a duet and try to find a fellow creator, a fellow artistic striver who could relate to this. And I'd written... speaking of angularity, I'd written a very angular melodic melodic line, and my inspiration was that song Spilt Needles. So I thought, well, there's a Shinsian factor here. Let me reach out to James Mercer. I'd never met him. Just reached out through the channels, and he said, well, send me the song. And we sent him the song. He said, yeah, I'm in. So it was as simple as that. he did his part, sent it to us, and we were mad for it. And we'd done several remote performances for the recent virtual Bonnaroo Festival. We did one for Stephen Colbert, and I just love him. He's a new great friend. And so that's a little different. That wasn't him reaching out to me. All these other ones were. But so now and then I'm allowed to reach out to people too.
This whole interview is just a giant ploy for us to eventually write together, but we can get to that afterwards. let's go with Kathy and your sons.
Well, okay. It's a deep bond. Tight family. I've been married for almost 37 years. I almost blew it. Got lucky and didn't. And we tried hard to have kids for several years. Tough luck. A couple of incomplete pregnancies. Went through difficult times, but man, it's worth the wait. We had our twin sons in 1992, and now they're almost 29. And one of them's in LA. It's not far from you. He has aspirations to be an actor, kind of. But he's mostly a mountain climber. He's out climbing crazy mountains, scaring the crap out of his parents daily. And his twin brother, Keith, is a professional basketball player in Germany. He played for LSU. Russell was a runner at Oregon, the climber. So he had a couple of hotshot jocks, and one of them's still making a living as a pro in Germany.
Amazing.
So proud of my family, obviously my sons and my work, my first wife. She's truly special.
Let's go with Bobby, your brother.
Well, I've referenced him a lot in this conversation because he was the real muso early on in our family. And he still is. He's still very active. Regionally around here, he's an in-demand bass player. You know, Bobby Hornsby was climbing the Cape Hatteras Lighthouse. Oh, that's right. That's not the right story. We'd locked ourselves out of a house in Virginia Beach, and he was pushing on the glass to get in, and the glass broke, and he split the tendon in his left index finger, and it was permanently locked. I'm driving him to the hospital. And they operated on it. So he plays with just these three fingers, bass, which is quite something. He's been doing this forever. Imagine not having the most important finger on your hand. Completely immobile. You could not move it. It's just rigid like a rock. So he's quite a guy. The original Deadhead. I guess he's been a big influence and a true great brother for many, many years.
And then obviously we have to do John as well, who you co-wrote.
John Hornsby, same thing, a truly a great brother. I'm the emotionally disturbed middle child. So I was probably, I was really close and had this close working relationship with my older brother, Bobby. And then later with my younger brother, John, as a collaborator, as a song, co-writer, co-songwriter. And so we had a serious run there as collaborators from, again, like I said, 82, about 93, when he just kind of got burnt out with it and just decided what he wanted to do something else. He's the one with the high academic credentials, Stanford degree, UVA law. You know, he's that guy. So we admire and love him as well.
When I talk to people and I look at their discography, a lot of times there are moments where it seems like there was, you know, long periods of self-doubt or questioning. And I'm sure all that is baked into a lot of the music that, you know, all musicians do.
Never ends. It never ends. Yeah.
Never ends. Yeah. But you always found a way. It's, you release an album essentially from 1986 all the way through some sort of music, not including the stuff you were doing for Spike, no, with no more than 2 years in between releasing music.
Yeah, I had a couple of 3 year breaks between records, between the last Range record in 90, Harbor Lights was 93, then 95, Hot House to 98, to Spirit Trail. But other than that, it's been pretty steady. So that's true. Just
really amazing. One more question before we sign out. I just wanted to talk real quick about the Tupac cover. It becomes so big and so part of his career. Like you said, it doesn't necessarily mean that it translated to radio play, but
who cares?
It clearly, for anybody who listened to Tupac ever, it's a staple. It's a greatest hit. How did it feel to see that song re-envisioned, 12 years later or whatever?
Yeah, exactly. 12. Yeah. Look, it was an amazing feeling. Because I loved what he did. I loved the message. It was a positive message and, just a great record. I got a cassette out of the blue from the Shakur Foundation. They were going through his voluminous files of sessions after he was assassinated. And they found this and they got in touch with me and they said, look, we found this and this is going to be the single off of his greatest hits record. And so we just wanted you to know about this so we can negotiate the publishing splits. And it was a way dirtier version, a whole lot more of the N word in there that got eradicated for the final greatest hits record. And again, I just thought it was a fantastic piece of music, a fantastic reimagining of what I had done. And then all these years later, just this year, the young Chicago rapper Polo G has redone that with a great song called Wishing for a Hero. And I think his reason for doing this, for remaking it, was to make the statement that, well, it's now however many years, 22 years later after changes, and things still haven't changed. It's still the same. We ended up doing a remote duet, Polo G and I, for the aforementioned Bonnaroo remote thing. It should be out on the internet at some point soon. So it was classic, man. It may be the first rap performance ever with no beat. The piano is the only rhythmic material, but he is just nailing it. I love it. Look, it's so special at age 65, almost 66, that I'd still get to work with Polo G, the Polo G's and Justin Vernon's and James Mercer's and Jamila Woods, just on and on. So yes, lucky bastard.
Not everybody who's in your position wants to work with people in different generations, and not everybody is inspired by music that evolves in one way or the other. And clearly,
I think they're missing something so much. I think they're crazy because so much music now is so creative and so interesting and gets under my skin. And they're just missing something. Most of my friends, not all of them, some are still pretty engaged with it, but most of my friends, I think, really are not interested in what's happening now in indie music, in adventurous music. I don't think so. I hope I'm wrong, but that's my impression. But so for me, I'm totally interested because it inspires me.
Well, thank you for doing this podcast because I think it's also important for this next generation to recognize who the innovators were before they were even, thinking about doing music. Some that, obviously were influenced by you in real time, and some that who didn't realize where those samples came from. Whatever the case is, it's important that we have these conversations so you can know who Glenn Miller is and you can know who, who you know Tupac is, and understand this wide variety of music. So that way, when you pull from these different influences, you can learn how to be unique and find your own voice. Which,
yeah.
as you said, it wasn't until you got back to the piano that people were like, "Oh, that's the guy." That's you.
Yes.
It wasn't somebody who's trying to be the new cool kid. It was just you were naturally just being you.
Exactly. It was, yeah.
Well, I just appreciate this, man. This is awesome. Really cool experience for me and for our listeners.
Well, thanks. I think increasingly as I get older, I'm ambitious and musically, and I'm just trying to often make a sound that I've never heard before. And that's not easy. So it leads me to some strange areas that really turn off a lot of my more maybe traditional listeners. Because when I mostly referencing the latest two records, especially the latest one, Not Secure Connection, is probably the weirdest record I've made. And I'm influenced by modern classical music in this atonal music, Elliot Carter, Olivier Messiaen, Arnold Schoenberg, on and on. That's what, because I love that. I loved it from, I mentioned it when we were talking about Berkeley, the Boston Public Library. I was immersing myself in all this, and I've continued to through the years. And now it's really more, it's coming out, unfortunately for a lot of my fans who really hate it, it's coming out in my music. And so, again, but I think it's just key. To try to make a sound that you haven't heard before. That's fucking hard to do. But sometimes when you can do it, it's a fairly euphoric feeling to go, you know what? I don't think anything I've ever heard sounds like this. And I really, that's very intoxicating.
Well, that's perfect. Great way to go out. Thank you, sir.
Okay. Thanks, Ross. Nice talking to you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of And the Writer Is. If you want to hear music from this songwriter I just interviewed, be sure to check out our Spotify playlist or visit our website at andthewriteris.com. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe to us. You can also like us on Facebook and Twitter. And the Writer is produced by Joe London, edited by Miles Bergsma, and published by Big Deal Music. A special thanks to David Silverstein from Mega House Music and Michael White. Until next time, this is Ross Golan.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.